Well, what I thought about today, which I want more of an interactive talk really than much of a lecture, because I think I've covered some of this material previously, is looking at the one aspect of the upper left quadrant from a perspective of what is psychological, to qualify what one means by psychological, because obviously psychological is a very broad term, and also you know, stuff like spirituality or cognitive ability and intellect and all those things are obviously sometimes classified under the psychological. But I'd like to make three, when I speak about the upper left quadrant, I like to just as abstract categories, because these things are obviously totally interrelated. But just for practical purposes, I like to classify it under three distinct areas. The one, the intellectual. So in a way, one can see it as three distinct lines of development in the upper left quadrant, although there's obviously more lines of development, but just sort of three clusters of lines. I like to make a distinction between intellectual development, emotional or psychological development, and then existential development or / spiritual development. So just for practical purposes, one can keep those three sort of separate, just to look at certain practices and certain therapies that fall under those areas, because those are also three areas or three clusters of lines of development that can also function fairly independently. As we all know, somebody can be very intelligent and, you know, knowledgeable, but it doesn't mean that psychologically they're well adjusted. And somebody can be, you know, do a lot of spiritual practice and have all sorts of spiritual experiences and spiritually knowledgeable, but they might not be intellectually, you know, savvy or bright or knowledgeable, and they might also not be psychologically well adjusted. So I think just for practical purposes, it's useful making a distinction between that. So when I speak about psychological, I refer to sort of specifically as what one would traditionally see as psychological, more around the emotional well-being, maturity, the capacity to handle feelings, capacity to express emotions, and all those type of things. So what I wanted to look at is what are the type of practices that one can do to promote what I call the psychological recovery dimension within the context of recovery from addiction. So I really want to give us all the opportunity to discuss that and see what are the practices that we are doing. What are the type of practices that's traditionally been sort of proposed by the recovery world, and what are the type of practices or what are the type of perspectives that an integral perspective can also bring to that? Because this, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the psychological dimension is fairly well understood in the recovery world. You know, if one looks at all the different books about recovery, not just addiction, but stuff like codependency and adult child and inner child and shame and, you know, all those type of things, recovery literature is pretty advanced when it deals with sort of emotional well-being. So just to get some of your guys' input around what you understand as psychological well-being, and perhaps what are some of the practices that you find useful at this stage, and then we can just maybe expand a bit on that.
Okay, so which one are we talking about first?
We're just going to look at the psychological well-being today.
Would exercise and eating good quality food fall under the psychological well-being?
Well, you know, for pragmatic purposes, I would classify that more under the upper right-hand quadrant. I mean, obviously those things are interlinked. That's why, like I say, it's difficult making a distinction between that. But I'm looking more at sort of psychotherapeutic practices that specifically focuses on the psychological aspect of one's development.
Okay. How about this course?
This is Victoria, and some of the things that are fairly new on the scene that I have seen as very effective are things like emotional freedom techniques, the tapping, and EMDR, which is the rapid eye movement therapy. And I would also see the binaural brain training to be part of helping people to shift at a much deeper level beyond just things like talk therapy, for instance.
Yeah, sure. So maybe to pose a question as well and get your feedback on that. What do you guys think is the main psychological problems? Because it also helps to identify what the issues are, because there's like 10,000 techniques out there for getting better in psychology. What do you guys think are the main problems that addicts have in recovery? What are the things that they really need to work on? Because obviously there's some things that isn't as pressing as other things. What do you guys think are the psychological issues that seem to underlie addiction?
Dealing with emotion. Finding a healthy outlet or a healthy way to manage emotions, to manage feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe I can just add to that, out of the three biggest high-risk situations for relapse traditionally has been identified as the first one is dealing with negative emotions and strong negative emotions. The other one is interpersonal relationships, and the other one is peer pressure. So difficult emotions is one of the biggest sort of risk factors and triggers when it comes to people in recovery that can cause them to relapse, and obviously one of the things that perpetuate the addiction as well. So yeah, I agree with you there.
This is Lisa. One of the things in Smart Recovery is like a 4-point program, and point 3 is self-management of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And we use a lot of tools under that because it is such a major thing. And also point 2 is managing cravings and urges, which could also be considered psychological. So we use a lot of tools in there, from cost-benefit analysis, which has been very helpful to me in decision-making in my entire life. Instead of getting caught up in emotion, I write down the costs and benefits of doing something and the costs and benefits of not doing something. I label them long-term and short-term, and then I get a picture of what's really going on. And it helps stabilize my mind, get it down on paper, and allow me to make a more rational decision. With emotions, I find using the REBT technique or the work of Byron Katie, which is similar, the ABCDE of REBT. And what we do with that is when we have an emotion that is upsetting, when we do it for emotions, we identify the emotion or consequence. We backtrack to the activating event, and then we identify the beliefs. And we take those beliefs and we dispute or we question the rationality or truth of them. And then we, in E, we find more effective beliefs that are just as true or truer, that will move us into a more successful reaction, move us into a more desirable reaction. So one of the things I love about Smart Recovery is it's just filled with tools like that. There's about 20 of them so that we can find the ones we really like. And I think it's a great adjunct to anybody in any recovery, like whether you're in 12-step or not. The Smart Recovery Handbook is just some great tools for self-management of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that I just, I use them all the time. Everything from brainstorming and problem solving to, you know, finding better coping statements, really becoming aware of what I'm thinking, because that's where my feelings are born from. That's where my behaviors are born from. So it's like going to the root of the problem as opposed to trying to cut off the branches. So I just find their stuff really great, and I do a lot of it. So that's what I do in that quadrant. Plus, I have a CBT therapist that I see. He's kind of fired me. He only sees me now once every 2 or 3 weeks, but which I guess is a good thing. But that's a lot of the primary psychological work that I do.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So that ties in very closely to what Amlet was saying, is basically managing feelings, and especially managing difficult feelings.
Yeah, destructive self-talk awareness is one of the tools we use. We identify destructive self-talk and learn how to refute it. There's just a lot of really good stuff in there.
Yeah, sure.
And nothing against 12-step programs, but there weren't those tools in there. Now, one thing that in the 12-step programs that I find really important for me as an addict is, and I thought they were so right on, in identifying resentments as a real tripping point for us. And so, and one of the things I'm doing right now is I started a group on Facebook, and we're doing 30 days of resentments, basically where we identify, we change it up each week, but I'm doing all resentments. We identify our beliefs about a person we resent. We have a worksheet for it, and we identify what the belief is, what we want from them, what we think we need from them, what we think they should do, and what we think about them. So we get all our judgments down on paper, and then we go through the process of questioning their rationality and looking at how we react when we believe those thoughts and how we would react if we didn't believe those thoughts. And then we turn the thoughts around to see where what we believe about them is also true about us. And we're doing it for 30 days straight, and it's really helping me. It's the way I did my four-step, I think I've mentioned before, but I think it's awesome because it works at the psychological level and the existential level too.
Sure. Absolutely.
Powerful stuff, just like totally life-shifting stuff. People are having an amazing experience. We've got 180 people doing this together, and it's just a beautiful thing to witness.
Okay. Well, I think that's sorry, I'm not tired.
I said I would also add to our list of issues that are pertinent to a person in recovery, in early stage recovery, I guess. I would also add managing free time, like boredom. Like, I think it's important to find a sense of purpose, to try to find something that kind of fills in this gap. Because I've seen a lot of my friends and people in recovery that they seem to relapse, A, when they're triggered strongly by a negative emotion. Either they got into a fight with their significant other, or they were dating. You know, like, you know, dating in very early recovery, especially with females, and they, something happened.
Go right on.
We lost Hamlet completely. He just dropped off the call. I'm sure he'll be right back.
But I agree with him. The exploring, we call it exploring vital and absorbing interests. And, if I hadn't developed kayaking and hiking and meditating and all those things, you know, he's so right. When I have too much time on my hands, if I don't know how to manage my mind, then I can get in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, and I normally add the meaning related stuff under the existential component of recovery. I try and keep it a bit separate from the psychological, but obviously it's completely interlinked with that as well. I think that's really at the foundation of a good recovery process, is to find meaning in the process. And that's why, you know, the things in the 12 steps are very often seen as a spiritual program. I don't agree that it's a spiritual program. I would rather frame it as an existential program. And the spirituality component of the 12 steps is what gives people a sense of meaning. So it's not necessarily the spirituality that's so healing. Spirituality is healing. But what spirituality provides is a sense of meaning. Because if one looks at people's basic and fundamental needs, spirituality is sort of seen as a fundamental need. But I think that's a slight misunderstanding from my point of view, is that what's fundamental about spirituality is the need for meaning. And some people get meaning via spirituality. In fact, a lot of people do. But there are also a lot of people that get meaning that aren't spiritual, that also are pretty content and well-adjusted. But they have meaning in their lives. So the
can you say what you mean by that, by meaning? What do you mean by meaning?
Guys, I'm back. I don't know if what happened, but I got kicked out of the call in the middle of what I was speaking about. I just got kicked out, so I don't know where you guys. I guess I missed out on what you were saying, guy.
Yeah. Well, I was just commenting on what you were saying, Amnit. I was just saying around that I agree entirely that really at the core of a recovery program is the existential component. What I mean by that is the having a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning in one's life and having activities that provide meaning. And I was just commenting on the relationship between what we perceive to be a spirituality and meaning or an existential perspective. And I was just saying that a lot of time spirituality or the need for spirituality is seen as a primary need. But I believe that underlying spirituality is a primary need, which is the need for meaning. And some people can get meaning via spirituality, and some people get meaning via secular things that aren't considered spiritual. And I think that's one of the strongest components of 12-step recovery, is that it focuses on spirituality, but what it actually focuses on is on the existential, providing people with a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning. Through many ways, and primarily through a sort of spiritual notion of recovery.
But when the 12 steps failed to do that, like when, yeah. It's very common where someone is trying to get clean and they're going to meetings and they have a sponsor and they may have a job, but they still lack, there's this angst, there's this boredom, there's this uneasiness. There's this lack of meaning in their life. Everything is blah. What do you say to somebody like that? How do you, is it up to each person to find what's meaningful to them and embark on that path, whether it's, it's going to be a new career or maybe extreme fitness or just yoga or meditation or exercise or whatever. Is it up to each person to find it? Or going to a church group or a spiritual community, what do you say to somebody who's in that, who's bored, who doesn't have it?
Well, I think that's a very important question, and a question that has plagued philosophers since the beginning of time, because it asks the simple question, is meaning inherent in the universe or is meaning completely relative? And that's obviously something that nobody has entirely figured out yet. The reality is that each of us is born with an innate need for meaning. Doesn't matter what culture you come from. You know, as Viktor Frankl and those guys said, that meaning is a basic human need. And I think one of the problems, as far as I'm concerned, with 12-step culture is that they tend to equate meaning and spirituality as the same thing. So you need to find meaning through spirituality, which I certainly don't believe is the only route to meaning. It works for a lot of people, but not for everyone. So a lot of people, when they get involved in 12-step programs, tend to find a sense of meaning. And obviously meaning is very often interlinked with what one perceives the transcendent to be. So if you have a certain idea of God or an higher power, then that is also going to influence what you perceive to be meaningful and morally right, etc. So a lot of people find meaning through spirituality, but there's also a lot of people that are in recovery that the spiritual component of the 12 steps don't provide adequate meaning for them. And I think then it's important to make a distinction between so-called spiritual meaning and secular meaning. And secular meaning is just activities that aren't related to, you know, the transcendent necessarily, that provides one with the reason to get up in the morning. And that's something that isn't that clearly articulated in 12-step culture. You know, people don't talk too much about hobbies or, you know, pursuit, that type of pursuits, which is unfortunate. And I think that's where an integral perspective can be very useful. But I think it's up to each person to find the things in the world that provide adequate meaning for them.
Yeah.
And maybe on that note, Viktor Frankl would say is that there's three routes to meaning. The one is, what does he call it? Experimental attitude. I can't actually remember now. I can have a look at it just now. And that pretty much meaning is available to us at any time. That, you know, at any given situation, one can find a meaningful pursuit. Because meaning is such an inherent thing in the world that it's really available to us at any time through a sort of artistic experience or having, you know, somebody to love or having a mission in life, like, you know, being in a band or creative values. And then there's also a third thing that he calls attitudinal values. Well, he calls it experiential values, creative values and attitudinal values. And the third one, attitudinal values, is one that 12-step fellowships focus on a lot, which is really one's attitude towards life. So even if you have cancer and you're dying, you can still find meaning of that by having a certain attitude towards that. So Frankl would say that the only thing we have complete control over is really our attitude. And it's in that attitude that one can also find meaning.
Heidi just stepping in because I just Googled Viktor Frankl to see what his three ways were too, and it's fun. His thing is called logotherapy. If any of you want to look it up, just the Wikipedia thing has a lot to say, and it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, his stuff is great. And I mean, he's the guy that said, you know, Freud and those guys said that the sort of main, you know, the main thing that makes us human, or the fundamental aspects of being human, is these sort of biological and psychological drives that we have. And what Frankl said is the main drive that we have in life, what makes us truly human, is the need for meaning. So that's a very fundamental need. And obviously addiction is a very powerful way to have to create meaning in one's life. Obviously something that doesn't work in the long run, but in the short term it's a profoundly powerful method for meaning creating. And I think that's why it's so attractive for a lot of people.
I really like how you separate spiritual meaning and psychological meaning. That helps me a lot because they really are very different. And, you know, I spent years in 12-step programs, and my spiritual path eventually didn't match up to a kind of monotheistic, dualistic spiritual perspective. It wasn't right or wrong, it just didn't match up. So I became very frustrated, and I felt very criticized. And then I finally had to find it in me what was true and make a decision of where I needed to be. But, you know, it is such a personal thing. And, you know, we often said in 12-step readings, oh, we have Buddhists, so we have... No, we don't. We really don't. We don't have that many people, Muslims and other religions. And especially for those of us with, like, an Eastern spiritual perspective, it can get very difficult to work the 12 steps the way that they are. Yeah. It just became very frustrating for me. And it was actually, for me, counterproductive. It might not, it's definitely not for others, but it was, for me, very counterproductive. I found myself, you know,
yeah.
you know what I'm talking about. So it is that, like Hamlet was saying, it is so important that we find our own way.
Yeah. I mean, the irony for me about the 12 steps is, if one looks at it sort of philosophically or reads between the lines, everyone accuses the 12 steps of being a religious program. You know, and I'm sure I might be sort of publicly stoned for saying this, but the 12 steps is actually a profoundly irreligious program. If one looks at one of its basic tenets, which says that it doesn't matter what higher power you have, as long as you have a higher power, it will work. So if one looks at that logically, what it says is it doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you believe something is going to work. Now, that only leaves two options. It either says that, you know, all these gods exist, therefore it doesn't matter what you choose, it will work for you, or the more logical option is that none of these gods exist. It doesn't matter what you choose, it will work for you. Because if only one of them existed or one of them had truth in, then it would only work for that group of people. So the extreme pluralistic element of the 12 steps actually says, listen here, the religious component doesn't work. Otherwise, if there was some truth in it, then only certain people would get it, you know, whoever chooses the right higher power. Therefore, none of these things are true anyway, but what is true is if you find a belief system that provides enough meaning in your life that supports you. So, in its extreme pluralistic element, it is actually profoundly irreligious by saying that you can choose anything. You know, if everything is wrong and everyone chooses the wrong thing, but it works for everyone, then it doesn't mean that everything is right. It actually means that, you know, none of it's right. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. The problem for me was it still says, I need a higher power. Like prayer and all that is a really big part of the 12 steps. And if you know anybody who is from some of the more non-dualistic points of view, we don't pray. It wouldn't even make sense to us to pray. Because
yeah.
To me, there's just, why would I want to interfere with, the universe is friendly. I trust life. I don't need to bully some power into doing what I want. So for me, it's egoic and irrational at a spiritual level. And so that's just what's true for me. And so, you know, an external God of any kind, it isn't that I disagree with it. It just, I can't relate to it. And it's not.
Lisa, that's
I'm talking about atheism.
That's a very point that you bring up, and it's one that I wouldn't say I struggle with, but I ponder sometimes, and I think John Dupuy may talk about it in his book when he's quoting Ken Wilber, where I think the way that I understand it is once you reach a certain understanding or if you adopt, I'm not going to say reach, but if you adopt a certain understanding or a certain belief in God, that is, that you are one part of,
then praying sort of becomes like obsolete. Well, then I'm not going to, how can I pray to something that's, you know, that's part of myself? And I've struggled with that, but there is a value, I guess, according to Ken Wilber, in that sort of dynamic or in that sort of relationship with God, where no matter what stage you are in, you still can find a benefit in a praying type of relationship. Guy, maybe if you know what I'm talking about, you can expand
a little bit
on that, because I do struggle with that as well, because I'm like, well, what am I praying to exactly here, you know? I was raised in a Catholic background, and at one point in my life, this is something that I don't talk about very much, but at one point in my life, I ended up in a Christian ministry. You know, I was homeless and I ended up in a Christian ministry. And in this facility, I became a newborn Christian, and I had what I would call profound spiritual experiences, profound, where I would see people, you know, you see these people on TV with their hands up in the air, and they look like they're, you know, high on LSD or having an orgasm, and they're, you know, I felt these things. They were a real experience. I felt these incredible, I call them implosions of spirit. It wasn't explosions. It was like these implosions of spirit. And it was a very real experience. So after 3 months being there, I said, you know, I don't need that. Like, I'm cured. I'm, you know, I told my girlfriend that I was not going to have premarital sex with her anymore. I was not going to curse anymore. My life was going to be dedicated to reading the Bible. And I came out of there and I slowly started to backtrack. And then, of course, I relapsed for the next 12 or 15 years.
Yeah.
But that was a very real experience. And
when
I think about that, I ask myself, man, what was that? Who was that God? What happened to me during that time? How come I haven't gotten those experiences today?
Well, the thing I just got to jump in and say that I noticed with that is your experience didn't require a belief system. I went through the same thing. I did the whole born again thing. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. What for me I noticed was that experience was that you talked about, that implosion, that was an internal connection internally. And the minute then I built a belief system around it, I attached a belief system around it, especially a very morally driven belief system. There's nothing wrong with morals. But what I'm saying is the minute I did that, I started to suffer again. And so for me, spirituality isn't about finding a belief system. For me, it's been dismantling all my belief systems. You know, I don't have a belief system. I'm free to experience my internal connection to that. And, you know, that's what I heard you say.
I'm not sure I understood what you said about establishing a belief system and then having that disconnect happen. I'm not sure I understood that.
Well, for me, the minute I moved out of an internal of the sacred and got intensely involved with the belief system of Christianity, it all went flat.
Okay.
And I disconnected. I spent more energy on the belief system than the internal connection to spirit. So what I've noticed as I've just, through the processes I do, I dismantle belief systems. I find myself more and more deeply connected when I don't have a belief about anything.
Yeah.
I'm so open, you know, and there's just such a, like you said, it's sort of what I got, Hamlet, that I really love was, yeah, my prayer is sitting in sacred connection, period. It wants nothing but that.
Right, right.
That's prayer to me.
Right.
It wants nothing, just that. But that's not the right perspective. That's just my experience. It's not a belief system. It's my experience.
Well, one must also add that some perspectives are righter than other ones, which is also important to see, because if one thinks all perspectives are equally right, then somebody like ISIS in, you know, Iraq can be seen as on the same level as, you know, the Dalai Lama. So, So I think, you know, Amulet, from what, you know, if I can comment on, you know, I've got a very cynical view on what most people perceive to be religious experience. And there's one area where I don't agree with Ken Wilber's idea of that spirituality is a line of development, and that you could put fundamental sort of Christianity on the same line of development to non-dual Zen. I think, you know, I mean, I don't know if I even should say it, but I see most, what most people perceive to be religious, I see more as a pathological manifestation of the need for meaning. And the more profound the religious experience is, the more profoundly it's correlated to psychopathology. I think it would be impossible for anybody to have a truly profound type of experience that one would normally find in a fundamental Christian environment that hasn't got some serious psychopathology, you know, which obviously, I mean, it's obviously a perspective that will be seriously contended against. But I think there's a big difference between a religious urge and an urge for meaning, or a spiritual urge and an urge for meaning. And that's why it's very important for me to make a distinction between the two. The spiritual religious urge is an urge to find something beyond oneself that one can, you know, have a relationship or find meaningful with, etc. Existential urge is just to find meaning. That doesn't have to be with the transcendent or something beyond yourself. In the modern world, these two seem to be blurred entirely. And like I said, for me, it's a very important distinction to separate the two. The stronger ones need to merge with, you know, an higher power or a God. I don't see that as necessarily a healthy thing, or certainly an innate need, because people aren't born with that. That is something that's acquired. There's a lot of evidence, and certainly my experience is that the stronger the need is for a sort of godlike belief, it's not an indication for me of somebody that's got a higher spiritual need or spiritual level of development. I see that in a different way. So just something on the second person perspective that I found quite useful from the idea of prayer. It's unfortunate that 12 steps use the word prayer, because it obviously puts a lot of people off. But if one takes the idea of a God or an higher power or the transcendent away entirely out of this equation, what prayer is communion with the thing you find meaningful. So let's say you're guitar playing, I'm praying to my guitar. That just doesn't sound right. But what a second person relationship is, what Ken Wilber and those guys also speak about, is the quality of your relationship to the object that you find meaningful. If it is God, then it is the quality of your relationship to God. But from a secular perspective, it can be the quality of your relationship towards anything. So for instance, for me, the most spiritual, meaningful, you know, whatever, you know, religious experience there is when I share time with my daughter. You know, for me, that is the ultimate in any form of prayer, you know, any of these spiritual words that you could use. But not by the furthest stretch of the imagination do I think that she's God or the transcendent to anything. But to me, that is the most authentic second person spiritual practice that I have in my life. But I don't have to see that in a religious sense or spiritual sense to have a profound sense of communion with something that I find entirely meaningful, because she's the most meaningful aspect of my existence. And I find that as, let's call it spiritual, as anybody would find it if they're praying to an higher power or not. So I think one needs to take away this idea that a subject-object relationship or subject-subject relationship in a spiritual way has to include the idea of higher power. It can be anything. You know, it's just traditionally been assumed that it has to be a godlike or an higher power type figure, but it really can be anything. You know. And if one starts seeing it in that way, then one can start seeing the meaning behind what the notion of prayer would signify, which really signifies a communion between one object with another object that is so close that it nearly becomes one thing. So if it's with one's daughter or with a lover or with a guitar or with climbing a mountain or with God or with Buddha or Jesus, whoever, the other object is not the relevant point here. It is the quality of the relationship between the two objects that's the relevant point, you know? So I don't think one should confuse that with the idea of higher power. So from a 12-step perspective, what they try and do is try and put emphasis on this relationship between oneself and the meaning one has in the world. But unfortunately, it's always sort of dressed up in this higher power stuff, which I don't think is the essence of it.
Yes, and especially with, you know, from the non-dual perspective, the idea of subject-object in and of itself isn't needed anymore, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And
yeah,
even
absolutely.
The data structure we talk about when we sit in prayer in the lodge, everything is God. Everything is God. No separation. You know, it's very similar, even though they use some dualistic terms, it's very similar in perspective. So the idea that I need a subject-object relationship for it to be spiritual is profoundly not true for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the notion that there has to be God in any notion, whether it's pantheistic notion is also not something that's required. I mean, I've always been an atheist, and I always will be, most likely. But I've always seen myself be very in tune with all of these things. But I personally have never had the need to include a conception of a higher power or the notion of a God in any of my, let's call it spiritual practice. For it to be, you know, meaningful for me.
And from what I understand, I'll shut up. The studies I've looked at, the research I've seen, indicates that the idea that you a spiritual, quote unquote, as you know, a spiritual relationship is required for one to be sober, is not statistically supported. The vast majority of people recover naturally without any massive intervention. So, you know, I find that an unhelpful myth that keeps people away from a community. And I don't know. I don't know if those studies are true or not. But what I do know is I know some very healthy people who don't have a significant spiritual life, who are psychologically healthy and have been sober for 20 some years, including my ex-husband.
Yeah, no,
and
absolutely.
So, I kind of quibble with, I mean, it drove me right out of the rooms that without a spiritual connection, you're going to relapse. Like, I'm not going to have a recovery that's based in that kind of fear. Not interested.
Yeah. No, it's absolute nonsense. But that is also that is people's interpretation of that.
It's in the big book.
Well, it is, but it isn't. You know, the thing is, it's unfortunate that the terminology is used in that way. But if one reads between the lines, it actually says something quite different to what it says. Like the intention in a way is different to what it's actually saying, which has always been one of my gripes with the big book and the phrasing of it. Because on the surface, it looks like it says one thing, but actually it says something profoundly different. You know, just the notion, I mean, like I said earlier, the notion that you can choose any higher power and that will work yourself, that's a completely irreligious notion. I mean, there's no religion in the world that would say, listen, just believe in anything and it will work for you. You know, so, I mean, it points out that the religious component is irrelevant, but as long as you develop an higher power, but what higher power actually means is higher purpose or some purpose in your life, whether that is an higher power proper or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of people in 12-step fellowships that aren't spiritual or religious, that it works for them. But unfortunately, it also puts a lot of people off to get there. But fortunately, a lot of people are at that level of development where they won't be able to find another sense of purpose than a very clearly defined sort of higher power. So for some people it works really well, but for other people it doesn't really work well. So I think in the land...
Sorry. I'm sorry, Guy. Go ahead.
Okay.
No, I was going to add that, yeah, I think it's up to the individual, really. I mean, I struggled staying clean for many, many years. The most I was able to put together in a very long career of using was 3.5 years, which I'm coming up on now again. And I don't have a, you know, devotion or practice to something greater than myself. Like, I'm not a, you know, like, I don't wear, you know, beads or a robe or anything like that. But what I think did it for me this time was to kind of find a conscious sort of love for something greater than myself. Like, this class did a lot for it. This course has done a lot for it because it did fill my weeks with an interest in sort of like growth and development. Like, let me understand these different aspects of myself, and that gave me more meaning. My sitting practice in the morning, you know, no matter how short it is sometimes, I hear John Dupuis says, you know, you have to sit for an hour, and I'm going to be one of those people that says, I wish I had an hour to sit every day. I mean, as it is, I already get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I sit for 20, 30, sometimes 40 minutes. I've never been able to sit for an hour. I just don't have the willingness or don't have the time. But that practice there, along with reading, and I've devoured books, has given me meaning, has given me something to fall in love with. And that has made the difference in my life, you know?
Well, exactly, and that's my whole point. So it doesn't have to be a spiritual notion of meaning. If you find meaning in anything, that is going to satisfy your need for meaning because your need for meaning is both in your need for love or need for care, which is basic human needs. So if you have that satisfied through any way, it's going to satisfy that need, and you'll get better. What I've never seen anybody get better in recovery, whether they're spiritual or not, or religious or whatever, is somebody that has got no meaning in their life. You know, absolutely nothing. They don't stay clean. So, there's a lot of people that don't stay clean even though they're profoundly spiritual. You know, if spirituality kept you clean, then why is there alcoholic priests? You know, if spirituality kept you clean, why is there, you know, womanizing, cocaine snorting Zen Buddhists. So, you know, and that is why, if one reads the Big Book clearly, in a chapter about religion, it makes it very clear that religion doesn't work. In fact, it's one of its premises in the preamble, religion psychology didn't work. So that's why it's erroneous to ascribe a religious component to the 12 steps, although it sounds like it, but that was one of Bill W.'s sort of initial things, is that religion just didn't work. So they tried to create, in 1930 language, a secular understanding of existentialism. But in those days, existentialism, the word didn't even exist. And pluralistic and postmodernism and all this, you know, hip words just didn't exist. So I think what they tried to do was actually to create a secular approach to an existential understanding of meaning by using pretty outdated Judeo-Christian language. And that's why it says on a sort of more closer reading, one sort of sees that impulse. But on the surface, it just looks like it's trying to promote a sort of religious or profoundly spiritual worldview.
One time my sponsor asked me, after we had done some step work, he asked me if my belief in a higher power was enough to help me stay clean. And I said this emphatic, it's like, yes. And he looked at me and he said, bullshit. And I go, well, what do you mean bullshit, dude? And he goes, your belief in a higher power isn't enough to help you stay clean. Absolutely not. And I took that at first as an insult. And listening to you now, I see where he was coming from. And, in the context of that day, that conversation, he was trying to narrow down the point that this obviously is going to be down to just a basic choice that I make. But listening to you now, I kind of see where he was coming from that day when he told me, bullshit.
Absolutely.
I said, what do you mean? I felt insulted. I was like, of course, I have this huge belief in a higher power. And he kind of put me in place because I dream a lot and I tend to be up in the clouds sometimes, you know. And that certainly grounded me. I was really, very, very good at the moment.
Yeah, it brings it back to all four quadrants again. I keep coming back mentally and thinking about what your sponsor just said is like saying, you know, the one thing isn't enough. It has to be more integral. And that's why I just love the integral approach, because it does have a beautiful way of looking at the whole.
Hello?
I don't know what that is. Sounds like Guy.
Hey.
Are you there?
I'm still here. It's just breaking up a bit there.
Yeah.
Can you guys still hear me?
I can hear you, but there's a lot of noise.
Yeah. Well, we've also ran out of time, so it's 9 o'clock.
I'll see you guys next week.
Great discussion. Yeah. Have a wonderful holiday, those of you in the States. And have a wonderful weekend, those who aren't.
Yeah, thanks. Will do. Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Thanks for the chat.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.